Everyone, welcome to David's Book Talk, and today we have a very special guest. His name is Gene Stone. He has written a new book on the secrets of people who never get sick, and he's here to talk about it. Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. I'm totally fascinated by your book,
I must say.
Tell me how this book came about. Reading all about these different people and how they keep healthy is just fascinating, but how did you get this book in print?
Well, I'm a journalist and writer. I've written about 30 books, and I've written a great deal about health. And as I write in the introduction, when I write about health, I'm very participatory. I tend to do whatever I'm writing about. So over the years, I've probably been through more medical and health procedures than just about anybody who's healthy. And I was always, and I always have been healthy, except that I used to get colds all the time. Every year I'd get two or three or even four really bad colds.
Wow.
And I noticed that there are plenty of people who weren't going to doctors and weren't going through all these medical procedures who are actually much healthier than I was and weren't getting these colds. So I began to think, maybe I've been talking to the wrong people. Maybe instead of talking to all these medical experts, maybe I should just go talk to the people who never get sick and find out what keeps them healthy.
And you actually went and visited all 25 of these people?
Actually, no. Some of the people live too far away.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, and some of them aren't alive, and some of them are mythical. But I would say I probably met 15 of them, and I talked to the others. And so what I, by the way, there are 25 people in the book, but I probably talked to 100. There were plenty of people who I decided that they really weren't appropriate for the book.
Hmm. And these are the 25 that really seem to work really well. I mean, now, are these things going to work for everybody? All 25 of these will work for any person?
No. No, I don't think anybody could say that these 25 secrets, each one of them could work for each person. What I'm trying to say is that there are ways to stay healthy that involve being proactive, and there's a very good chance that 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 of these secrets could actually do what they did for me. Since I've been researching this book, I haven't been sick. I haven't gotten a single cold. This is the first time in my life I've gone, 2.5 years without being sick. And I do about, well, I tried every one of them, except one, which we'll get into because I couldn't do that one.
Uh-huh.
But I tried all of them, and I probably do maybe 10 of them now.
Hmm. I'm fascinated. Just fascinated by the whole thing. I mean, just reading all these. And they make a lot of sense, a lot of them, well, except for the one that's eating dirt.
Eating dirt makes sense, but we'll get there. But it makes sense. It's just I had to put a little fancier headline rather than say, allow a little dirt on your vegetables. That just always sounded catchy.
No. And people hear that and they think, oh, he's a quack. He can't possibly know what he's talking about. If he's talking about eating dirt, how can you eat dirt?
Well, you know, eating dirt is actually another way of saying the hygiene hypothesis. And the hygiene hypothesis is something that is very popular now in medicine and in research. And what it basically says is that we have been over-scrubbing and over-sterilizing, over-antibacterializing our environment to a degree where we're not giving the immune system anything to do. Because the immune system is like a standing army. It's just ready to attack. And if you don't give it anything to do, it tends to attack itself, like friendly fire.
Wow.
And that's how you get autoimmune diseases. So the idea with the hygiene hypothesis is if you can give the immune system a little something to do, it won't turn on itself. And a lot of research now shows that, for instance, kids who grew up playing in dirt and having dogs and cats and being exposed to a lot of microorganisms are far less likely to have allergies and asthma and other autoimmune diseases when they get older.
That makes sense. I mean, just thinking about it. How has this benefited you, the ones that you're doing, other than not getting a cold? In what other ways? Do you feel more of a vitality? Do you feel more energy than you did before?
I'm not sure if I feel more energy per se, but I feel a lot better because after so many years of just knowing, oh, my God, I'm going to get sick this season, I'm going to get sick this season, I used to have to I'm a freelance writer. I used to have to schedule my life around the fact that I would get these bad colds. And I don't get them anymore. So that makes me feel great.
I'll bet. I'm just wondering, when somebody's reading this book and reading all the 25, how do you decide which ones you're going to do? Is it,
right.
Are there some, that, like you said, there's some that are beneficial for some and not other people? I mean, how do you decide? Now, I mean, vitamin C is easy. Everybody, you just get some vitamin C pills and take them. And that seems very simple.
Right.
But
I talk at the end of the book about the thing that, or the major commonality, the thing that binds all of these people in the book, and there are two of them, and one of them is the fact that they've made their secret a habit. So what I try to say to the reader is, if, for instance, aerobic exercise, running, I talk about running in the book, well, if you're only going to run once every month, then it doesn't make sense for you to do it. When you read the book, what you want to do is figure out which of these secrets make sense in your life. Some of them just simply aren't going to be something you can do. I have a chapter on napping. Napping is terrific for your health. But if you've got a high-stress job and you're working from 10 in the morning till 7 at night, then napping isn't going to work for you.
Unless your boss is very lenient.
Unless your boss is very... And actually, there are some companies now that have napping rooms because there's been so much research showing that naps are really good for your health and they increase your mental capacity. So if you're a good boss, why not let your employees go take a nap rather than have them sit at the desk half asleep all day?
I used to take naps on Sunday afternoons from like 2 to like 5 before I went to church at night. I would take like a 4-hour nap, and it always invigorated me.
A 4-hour nap is a lot longer than what I'm recommending.
Yeah.
Well, but if you can do it, that's great.
I guess that's true, but naps are a certain time length, I guess. But
my naps tend to be about 20 minutes. The sleep research that I talked to said the ideal nap is actually an hour and a half. Because in 1 hour and a half, you get the entire cycle of sleep that you're supposed to get. There are five stages. There's stage one, stage two, there's stage three and four, which is shortwave sleep, and then there's rapid eye movement, which most of us have heard of, REM, which is stage five. And so in the course of an hour and a half, you will get all five stages. And that's why people recommend that... It's better to sleep, let's say, 3 1.5-hour sessions at night than it is, let's say, to sleep for 10 hours, but you're waking up every half an hour.
Right.
Because if you're doing that, you're not getting the full hour and a half. The interesting thing about sleep is they now say that sleep is cumulative. In other words, it used to be thought that you had to get your 8 hours of sleep every night, and that put a lot of stress on people.
Right.
But the recent thinking is that sleep is cumulative. In other words, if you can get that 8 hours of sleep, or let's say those 5 or 6 1.5-hour intervals of sleep, any time during the day, any time during a 24-hour period, you're getting the required sleep you need. It doesn't all have to come
at once. And we're not talking sleeping and nodding off at work. That's not really sleeping.
No, that's not really sleeping. That's just.
And I had somebody tell me the other day that they are okay with 3 hours of sleep a night.
You know, I run into a lot of this, and I
you believe that?
Well, I believe they believe it. But I don't necessarily believe that it's really true. You know, there's always going to be the outliers on both sides of the spectrum. There may be somebody who absolutely needs 11 hours of sleep, and there may be some people who can get by on just 3.
But you believe you need 8 hours of sleep a day. Do you believe that?
I believe that most people definitely do. But you can never say in health or human behavior that everybody needs something,
right?
Because we're all so different. And one of the things that has been troubling medical science for some time now, so many of the studies that we've relied on were all done, let's say, on, particularly up to the 50s and 60s and 70s, were all done on 180-pound white men. You know, and it's only recently that people have realized that a lot of these studies that we took for granted were done on white men with a certain kind of metabolism and a certain kind of weight pattern, and they may not have been a slightest bit valid for women or people of other races. And so what they're trying to do now in these studies is either very specifically look for research that pertains to one kind of person or try to bring as many different people as possible into the equation.
And the scary thing is, my friend who says he only needs 3 hours of sleep is a driver for a living.
Oh, no, that is scary.
And you talk about scary. I don't want a guy who only gets 3 hours of sleep driving in my neighborhood.
But he's like a cab or a...
No, a delivery driver, like milk.
Oh, man.
So, I mean, it's milk, which is really good for you, actually. But
no, it's not. Animal protein, one of the things I say.
Oh, it's not? Milk is not good for you?
You're not good for you.
Wow.
I'm standing up against the milk lobby and probably going to get in trouble for it. But there has been there's a chapter in the book called The Plant-Based Diet.
Right.
And what I talk about is how animal protein, more and more studies are saying that animal protein is not good for you. And in fact, there are a lot of studies that show that, because there's also a chapter on pH balance,
right,
that milk is very acidifying. So in order for the body to balance that acid influx that it's getting from milk, it needs to alkaline up the body, and it does that by leaching calcium from your bones. The countries that have the highest milk consumption, which are Sweden and Denmark and Canada and America, also have the highest rate of osteoporosis.
Really? I've never heard anybody say milk is bad for you. That's really, really surprising.
Like, you know, telling you there's no such thing as Santa Claus.
Yeah. No, it's something that we've heard all our lives, how good milk is. But milk does have vitamins. You agree with that?
I'm not saying that milk is just poison, but I am saying that based on a lot of the research that I looked into, and by the way, the book I wrote before this book, I ghostwrote for a firefighter in Austin named Rip Esselstyn, and it's called The Engine 2 Diet, and it's a book about how this vegan firefighter, this professional, one of the world's top triathletes, got his whole firehouse to go vegan. And if you know anything about firefighters, they don't tend to be vegan.
No.
Their refrigerator, it's all ice cream and steak. But he was able to convince them all using a book called The China Study by Colin Campbell.
I've heard of that book.
That's a great book, and it's where I get a lot of my facts from. And basically, it's the book that all of us plant-based diet people look to. But also, Rip's father, who was a surgeon at the Cleveland Clinic, he wrote a book on preventing and reversing heart disease. And he did a 20-year study at the Cleveland Clinic and came up with the same conclusion, that you should avoid animal protein and get your protein and your other vitamins and minerals from a plant-based diet.
Which I, and having had heart trouble just recently, actually, earlier this year, I'm dying to hear all about the heart, what's good for the heart. So.
what kind of diet do you have now?
It's really just low fat, low cholesterol, low sugar, really.
Did your doctor say anything about plant-based diets?
Well, yeah. I mean, I can eat that. He didn't say anything against them. He didn't specifically say eat plants. I don't know that they go that far nowadays. They just want you to not have so much fat in your diet.
Yeah, some of them do. There are doctors who will actually say so. In fact, I don't know if you noticed, 2 or 3 weeks ago, President Clinton announced he was going to start a plant-based diet. It was going to cut out all animal product. And actually, when he did that, he credited Colin Campbell and Dr. Esselstyn, the two people I just mentioned, for having changed his lifelong addiction to meat and dairy.
That's really great.
Yeah, and President Clinton, as you know, is not somebody you associate with being an ascetic. This is a man who clearly spent most of his life doing whatever he felt like doing.
Now, how long have you been a vegan?
About 3 or 4 years.
Do you see a difference in yourself being a vegan now and before when you weren't?
Yeah, I mean,
what difference is you're a little thinner, but what, you feel different? Do you have more energy?
Probably. I think what makes me feel best is that I'd always had something of a high cholesterol level. Whenever I took a lipid profile test, the results were always pretty bad. My cholesterol was around 240, and my doctor wanted me to go to statins, but I didn't really want to take them. So I went on this plant-based diet, became a vegan, and my cholesterol level went from 240 to about 170, and my HDL, or my healthy cholesterol, went up, and my LDL, or my lethal cholesterol, went down. And my doctor goes, well, what happened? And I told him, and he said, well, I can't really believe that's what happened. So he asked me to do it again. So I took the test again, and I still got the same results. So basically I had to talk him into believing that going from animal protein to plant was the thing that made the big difference in my lipid profile.
And plants, I mean, meat's very expensive nowadays anyway, so it's not really a great way to go anyway. And then meat that isn't expensive is very bad for you anyway.
Right. And by the way, everything in this book is basically free. One of the things I'm trying to do here is say that you don't have to spend money on health. Pills are expensive, doctor visits are expensive, insurance expensive. The 25 secrets in this book, I think the most expensive is probably chicken soup. And, you know, what's that? If you really want to, you can get a low-sodium Campbell's chicken soup for, you know, a few dollars.
Right, even the low-sodium soups, they have a lot of sodium in them.
Well, I would actually recommend no sodium.
Right.
But I'm not telling other people they have to do that. I do have a section on salt in the book and talk about what appears to be a fairly unanimous negative opinion of it.
Right.
But it's very hard to change people's diets. Usually, the issue is that they don't change unless they have to change.
And we're in such a fast-paced world, people are going to work, they come home, they have a few hours before they go to bed, and they don't have time to make all these decisions, you know, do all these things.
One of the good pieces of news is that after I wrote that book with Rip, the vegan firefighter of Texas, John Mackey, who's the CEO of Whole Foods, hired Rip away from the fire department to start a line of healthy foods, plant-based healthy foods that were easy and convenient for Whole Foods. So starting in January, instead of having to like worry about how do I make a plant-based meal, you can just go to Whole Foods and buy ready-made meals and canned sauces and pastas just off the shelf.
I wonder if I have a Whole Foods place in my area. That sounds like a good idea.
Where do you live?
In Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Oh, there's got to be one.
I'll have to find one. Yeah. That's a definite... Because, you know, when you have trouble, when you get sick, and I'm actually on statins right now, so... As we should tell everybody, you can't just do these without telling your doctor either. You can't just decide. I mean, or can you?
No. Gosh, I would never...
No,
ever,
I didn't think
you know,
so.
I love my doctor. I have nothing against doctors. I think that doctors save lives, and doctors can be great people. Doctors don't know everything. And so, you know, you want to have a back and forth with your doctor. I don't think there's anything in this book that you would go to a doctor and he would say, that's craziness, don't do that. But I do think that any time you're going to make any change in your life, it's always a good idea to check in with your doctor and let him know.
And I mean, what made you decide? You said you saw about 100 different people. What was the clincher as far as knowing that those people would work in your book? I mean, did you research everybody fully to make sure that it was really changing their life, or how did you do that?
It was different for each person. Sometimes it was just instinct that I just didn't think the person I was talking to was telling me the truth, or I didn't really believe it. And sometimes the person I was talking to was a little, you know, crazy. Because, unfortunately, sometimes in health you run into some crazy people. And sometimes the people were great, but the secrets they espoused I didn't think were really appropriate. I wanted to have secrets that were, as I said, basically free or very inexpensive and that were scientifically verifiable. I wanted the secrets in the book to be things that I could do scientific research on and find out that, yes, there's a lot of evidence that says this is good for you. And I wanted to do secrets that, frankly, I thought other people could do. I didn't want anything that was too weird or, you know, it would make people feel like, oh, this is really, like, not something I would ever put in my life. I think most of the things in this book, if not all of them, can be done by anyone except one. The one secret in the book that really isn't shareable is that, do you know about Blue Zones?
Yes, I was reading, I just remember your book.
Right. Dan Buettner, the guy from National Geographic, has been writing about Blue Zones for some time now. And these are five places in the world where people are remarkably healthy. And unfortunately, you can't just go to that place and then become one of those people.
Right.
But what you can do is replicate part of what makes them very healthy in terms of their exercise, in terms of their diet, in terms of their social support systems and such.
Yeah, it's important to have friends. You mentioned that in the book. And
yeah, it's interesting that for almost the history of medicine, the idea of a social support system being part of a good medical plan, I don't think anybody ever really thought about it. But there's been a lot of research recently on friends as being very medically beneficial and that social support systems aren't just something that can keep you healthy, but that... there is a Harvard study that came out in 2008 that says that strong social ties can protect against memory loss and cognitive disorders. And there's another study from the Journal of Clinical Oncology that said that women who didn't have a social support system had an elevated risk of mortality after cancer. There's just study after study that shows that the stronger social ties... In fact, there was another Harvard public health study that of, I think it was 28,000 men, and said that the men who didn't have strong social ties were 20% more likely to die within a decade than those that did.
Makes me want to go out and make lots of friends tonight.
There you go. It certainly makes you value the friends you have. They're keeping you alive.
Yeah, it's a very suspicious world out there, too, so it's not easy to make friends. I mean, there's people that want to be in your life, but they don't necessarily want to, you know, be your close friend.
Absolutely. It's one of the tougher issues in the book, because there are certain things that, for instance, eating garlic or eating brewer's yeast, you know, that's just going to the store, buying buying garlic or brewer's yeast and adding it to your diet. Having a positive attitude, being spiritual, making friends, those are also secrets in the book. It's a lot harder to say to somebody, okay, have a positive attitude, or okay, get spiritual. And it's very hard to say to somebody, okay, make more friends. But I'm hoping if enough people realize that friendship is this beneficial for their health, more people will be receptive. So if you get somebody else to read the book, maybe they'll be more likely to be your friend.
Is garlic beneficial as brewer's yeast? I mean, are they both equally as beneficial in your eyes?
Yeah, you know, garlic, it's interesting. As I said, I've tried all of the secrets,
right.
Except, as you now know, I couldn't...
Well, which ones work best for you?
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that garlic, for me, is the one that I think, and this is just a gut reaction, I don't really know, because I wasn't able to divide myself up to 25
right.
people and do a controlled study and see which one really worked, but if I just had to guess, my sense is that garlic is the one that has been best for me. It's interesting, garlic has been around for 5,000 years as a cure-all. It's an antibiotic, it's an anti-inflammatory, it's an antioxidant. Garlic is an amazing substance. It's only really in this last century, in the 20th century, where people kind of started being more dependent on pills and doctors and Western medicine that garlic basically fell out of favor. But I think garlic is just the most remarkable substance you can eat. And I travel. In fact, I've been doing a book tour recently, which is a very grueling thing to do.
Right.
I've been taking my garlic with me, a big bulb of garlic, which has been a little odd for the security people who look at it and think I'm some sort of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Right, and that's the thing. People are going to think that. People think you're a little weird to begin with, you know, when you say all these different things. I mean, they, you can't prove it to them immediately. And unless they go home and try it, they're not going to know whether it really works or not.
No, and that's why I never say to people, look, I want you to try all 25 of these secrets. But I do say, look, if you feel like your health could stand some improvement, and you know, very few people are going to say it can't, then I just highly recommend you try a few. But again, as we said before, try the ones that make most sense for you. Don't do something that is going to make you feel stupid or silly or something you can't add to your life. Try something that you know you can do, and if you want to do it in private, nobody even has to know about it. Garlic is obviously something that for some people is difficult because you really have to eat it raw to get the allicin.
Yeah, it doesn't work if you eat it in a pizza.
It's not as good, and there's some research, in fact, that says it isn't good at all. There's other research that says differently. My feeling is that raw garlic probably is the best way to go. For some people, that's they don't like the taste and also makes their breath smell, but there is a natural antidote, and that's parsley. If you can eat some fresh parsley after you eat the garlic, your breath will sweeten up.
And parsley is good for you, too.
And it's good for you, too.
It's a plant-based, another plant-based one.
I find that, and I don't really like the taste of garlic at all, frankly, when it's raw. What I do is I eat the garlic, and then I always make sure I have a piece of dark chocolate around.
Right.
And dark chocolate, by the way, has resveratrol, which is the antioxidant that's been found also in red wine and grapes. So a little piece of dark chocolate is actually good for you, and it tastes good.
Oh, it certainly does. I mean, who doesn't feel good after they eat a piece of chocolate?
Chocolate is one of those universally loved foods. It's only been around for a few hundred years in its present form. In fact, I think it's only in the 1850s that they perfected how to make a chocolate bar.
Right.
Before then, people had to drink it. And before that, of course, since it comes from the New World, people didn't know about it.
What do you say to people who want to try these things out, but also want to have a little bit of dessert, want to have some food that's not so good? Do you really have to cut all that out completely?
No, not at all. Not at all. I have a sweet tooth, so, you know, I have dessert.
Give us an example of something you eat that's sweet.
Well, as I say, I'll do anything with chocolate.
No chocolate.
Dark chocolate. I won't have milk chocolate because I'm vegan, but I do enjoy dark chocolate. And there are plenty of soy-based and coconut milk-based or hemp-based ice creams and frozen desserts, if that's what you really want to do. New York has been flooded recently with a variety of vegan bakeries. For instance, Baby Cakes on the Lower East Side makes incredible vegan treats. They're not necessarily good for you, but they're really tasty.
I should have mentioned, this book is published by Workman. How did they react when you first told them the idea of doing this kind of a book?
Workman is a terrific publisher. They're proactive. They really get involved, but they don't do many books. so they only want to do books that they really feel they can get behind. But the good thing about this is the title, The Secrets of People Who Never Get Sick, they just liked it from the start. They heard that title, and they said, well, this sounds really great. However, because they are a very conscientious publisher, and as I said, they only want to work with books that they feel comfortable with, they made me write a proposal that when I finished it, they said, well, this isn't really what we're looking for. Can you do it again? So I went back and I rewrote it, and then they said, well, this isn't really quite right, but you're mostly there, so I had to rewrite it again. And things sort of fell into place. In the book, The Secrets of People Never Get Sick, which is simply originally just about the secrets, it only occurred to me about halfway through that I should add things like, for chicken soup, a chicken soup recipe, or for cold showers, how to take a cold shower, or for stretching, actual stretching exercises. So it went from a theoretical book to a practical how-to book.
I think it works better that way. I think that's a wonderful idea.
Oh, it wasn't even my idea, frankly. I think that you must know the publishing world from talking to
yes.
so many writers.
Mm-hmm.
If you're lucky enough to get a publishing house and an editor who really know what they're doing and really back you, it's gold. It's a wonderful thing. And Workman and my editor, Susie Bolotin, have been so supportive. And the other thing is, as you probably know this too, a lot of times you turn in a manuscript, you don't really get edited anymore. Susie was an extraordinary editor and went over the book word by word to make sure that we were on the same page, literally.
Now, Andrew Weil, who has a quote on the outside of the book, very nice quote, does he follow these too?
I mean, I don't agree with Andy on everything. The reason I know him is that his wonderful book, Spontaneous Healing, he has a chapter on a man he considered his mentor, Robert Fulford, who was an 88-year-old osteopath who lived in Ohio at the time. And I ended up writing a book with Dr. Fulford. And Dr. Fulford was, as Andy said in Spontaneous Healing, one of the most remarkable people who ever lived. Andy went all over the world looking for the greatest healer he could find. You know, when you think of places you'd go, he went to the Himalayas, he went to the Andes, he went to mystical places, and he finds this guy in the United States, this 88-year-old doctor, and Robert Fulford really was a great healer. He did amazing things with me when he did his hands-on examination of my body, and that's why in the book there are his exercises under the stretching chapter. But to answer your question, I didn't agree with everything he said, he didn't agree with everything I said, Andy and he didn't agree on everything. You know, you're almost never going to find unanimity among people who have strong opinions about health.
Mm-hmm.
Andy is a big advocate of fish oil, which I'm not. Dr. Fulford was, you know, he's a 88-year-old guy. He loved to have his bologna sandwich at lunch. You know, I don't think either Andy or I said that was a good thing to do, but he felt it was fine for him.
Yeah, bologna is such a wonderful, it tastes so wonderful. I don't eat it. I can't eat it with my heart the way it is right now, but and that's the thing with food. I mean, when it tastes good, you just want more of it. And you know
that's true. But I got to say that one of the things I learned is I was always, I don't know if I was a glutton per se, but I certainly wasn't a gourmet. One of the things that you realize when you stop dumping lots of oil on your food, you stop eating lots of fat, you don't use salt, and you don't use all those incredible additives, you start learning what things actually taste like. I only recently realized what broccoli or Brussels sprouts or some of these things actually did taste like, because I used to just drown them in sauces and all kinds of other additives that took away the taste.
Right. Yeah, you don't. I mean, you're right. But people that don't do these think that I could never adjust to that. I mean, away they're telling themselves they can't do it. You know, and
that's why a lot of people really don't come to some of the dietary related issues until their doctor says you have to.
Now, have there been, when you've done all this tour, have there been people on your tour that have tried some of these already?
Oh yeah, yeah.
What's been the reaction? Tell me some of the things they said to you.
The reaction has actually been really great. The sort of the showier ones in the book have tended to get the most comments, things like taking cold showers or dunking your head in hydrogen peroxide.
Yeah.
But some of the other ones have been more familiarly done. For instance, because I've been talking about garlic so much, I've run into a lot of people who say, hey, I took your advice on garlic, and I don't necessarily like the taste of it, but it seems to be working for me. I feel really good.
I'm going to have to go out and get some garlic. I mean, seriously, I'm curious. I mean, if it's really going to help me out. I don't think I ever get colds. I mean, very, very rarely do I get a cold.
But on the other hand, you did have a serious health issue.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. See, it's funny. I was exactly the opposite. I've never had a serious health issue, but I would always get these bad colds. And obviously, I'm very grateful that I don't have any serious health issues. But bad colds are a drag.
They certainly are. Do you expect to live to 100? Do you ever think about how long you're going to live? I mean,
I do. I wrote a book called Ultra Longevity for the medical director of Canyon Ranch, the health spa.
Right.
So when I was writing that book, frankly, I thought about it all the time. The issue of longevity is it's not that you want to live to be 100 if you can't live to be 100 and be healthy.
Right.
You know, I don't want to be 100 if the last 30 years of my life I'm really miserable. So what I would rather do is live as long as possible, as healthy as possible.
I guess most people would feel that the same way. I mean, I just think, well, if I made it to 100, I'd feel, imagine how I'd feel. You know?
Well, but again, I've run into a few centenarians who are just amazing. They're so vital and awake and alert. And then I've run into people who are 65 and are clearly on the decline. It's very hard to understand at this point exactly why that happens, but I'd like to think a lot of it has to do with lifestyle choices.
And I wonder how much of it's the will to live, too. I mean, being able to interview like I do here, I mean, it gives me a strong will to live. I mean, just to go on and have fun. Each interview is more fun than the last. And
well, one of the secrets in the book is positive attitude, and I suspect that that might be the strongest but the most difficult of all the secrets. Everybody, that was another commonality of everybody. Everybody had a secret in the secrets of people who ever got sick was somebody who believed strongly that their secret worked for them.
Right.
Positive attitude has been studied a great deal in the last 10 or 15 years. Ever since Norman Cousins wrote his book about how his good mood changed his cancer and the field of psychoneuroimmunology started. And there have been some amazing studies. The most extraordinary study was one done at Baylor University in the 90s where they took 10 people who were going to have knee surgery. Two of them, they were all told they would have the same surgery. Two of them were given the entire surgery. Three of them were given part of the surgery. And five of them weren't given any surgery at all as far as they knew, although they were all operated on.
Right.
All 10 of them came away with the same result. They were all fine. Because all 10 of them had been told that their surgery had been successful.
How interesting is that?
Yeah, and there's been study after study that shows that the relationship between the mind and health is so powerful, more powerful than we can imagine.
Now, what does your doctor say when you tell them you're on an all-plant diet? I mean, are they supportive of that?
They're supportive. They're a little suspicious because doctors, for the most part, certainly the older doctors, never really took any nutrition and diet courses in their training. The idea that nutrition and health, which just seems to be common sense, of course they're related, is actually not something that has been taught in medical school until fairly recently. So there's definitely some doubt on the part of doctors. And, you know, doctors, as I said, I think doctors are great. I'm not knocking them. I'm very dependent upon my doctor, and
right.
I go to him whenever.
I'm glad. That's refreshing to hear that. You think somebody would write a book like this would think, you know, that I don't need a doctor. If they never get sick, they don't need a doctor.
Well, I have to say that when I originally thought about this book, I thought I would do it as a ghostwritten project for a doctor, but I couldn't find a doctor who said there were that many people who never got sick, because in their worldview, of course, they only see people who are sick.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, I think Western medicine has a lot going for it. And certainly if I break an arm or I get run over by a car, you know, I'm not going to go to an acupressure guy. I'm going to go to an emergency room. But I also think that there's so much in the ways of old, in the herbs, in the foods, in the exercise, in the attitude, in detoxification. There are so many things that aren't part of Western medicine that are clearly powerful and some things that people in this country really need to know more about.
And you were mentioning what was that word, centenarian?
Centenarian, to the people live to be 100.
That's not a word I use very often, but yeah.
You don't know many.
Speaking of which, you mentioned George Burns in the book, which is interesting.
Yeah.
He has some really interesting things to say about eating half of what you would normally eat.
Yeah, my agent was his agent, and he went to visit George when he was
Oh, really?
In his 90s, and he asked him what his secret to health was, and George just looked at him and said, eat half. And the fact is, there has been a great deal of research that says caloric reduction, cutting your calorie intake by 25-30%, is not only a way to increase the likelihood of longevity of your life, but also a way to make you very healthy and make your immune system strong.
And it seems to me, with these 25 here, I mean, if you get a couple friends and have everybody tries a different one, that could be interesting too, and meet and see, you know, what's working for who.
Yeah, I should probably start some clubs, some secrets clubs.
And that makes me want to ask you, do you do any teaching on this? It seems like you'd be great teaching a class on this.
You know, that hasn't come up yet because the book has been out for 3 weeks. But as I've been going around the country, I already find myself in instead of reading from the book, which is what takes place in a lot of readings, what I found is much more effective is simply to ask people if they can guess what the secrets are at the start of the hour. And I find that, for the most part, that takes me through the entire hour, because people really do want to talk about it, and then they want to hear what research I've come up with, since I am something of a walking human guinea pig, and I've tried so many different things in my life.
Yeah, and it's just interesting. I mean, you read through this book and you're thinking, wow, that sounds really cool. I should try that. And, and before you know it, you're thinking, I should just try every one of these. And
tell you, if you say garlic would be the one that you would do.
I definitely. Garlic and brewer's yeast and the vitamin C, too.
By the way, a tip on the brewer's yeast is to make sure that when you buy it at a health food store, you get debittered brewer's yeast, because if you don't, it can be kind of a shock to your system.
Debittered. Huh.
Debittered. Yeah, they debitter it so it tastes better.
I wonder if that would conflict with my heart medicine.
I talk to the doctor. But don't do anything until you talk to the doctor. But I can't imagine that it would. There are certain herbs, and I talk about this in the book, that do conflict with pharmacological remedies, and there are even some foods. Grapefruit, for instance, can interfere with the interaction of certain drugs.
Oh, really?
So you really do want to check before you add anything unusual to your diet.
Right. I usually eat, you know, I eat a lot of grapes and fruit, but I haven't eaten grapefruit, but now you got me thinking now what I should eat and what I shouldn't eat.
Well, you really do. I mean, I'm sure your doctor has given you a sheet that tells you, for all of your whatever drugs you're taking, what has serious interaction.
Yeah, I just can't eat a lot of dark green stuff unless I eat the same quantities every night, so it doesn't affect my levels. Uh-huh. But I won't go in too much with that. Would you say you're a happier person doing these?
Well, that's the whole reason. In fact, this book is called The Secrets of People Who Never Get Sick. I actually was thinking that the next book should be The Secrets of People Who Seldom Get Fat. But I think that's a whole other issue that I'd love to talk about. Because like many people, you know, I've had my ups and downs. And I've discovered that there are some things you can do that can keep you happier than other things. And by the way, keeping in good health definitely keeps you happier.
Absolutely. Getting out and taking a walk in, that can change your whole night.
Absolutely.
I mean, just getting some fresh air. We forget how important fresh air is sometimes.
Yep.
Because in the wintertime, you know, when it's cold out, you don't feel like walking.
No, that's why it's one of the good things about having a dog, is a dog will get you outside, besides exposing you to the advantages of the hygiene hypothesis.
We're all so such ritual people. I mean, everything done the same time every day.
Yep.
And do you find you do that yourself?
Well, I'm a writer, and as anybody who's a writer knows, the key to writing is self-discipline. And so the only way I can get my work done is if I do establish routine. I go to the gym in the morning. I'm not a morning person, so I do my phone calls and my email before lunch. I have lunch with somebody around 2 o'clock. I can start getting my writing done. Sometimes it doesn't happen until 3 or 4. And I have, like, I'm allowed a certain amount of chocolate per day, so I eat that at certain times. I think my life is probably very ritualized.
Now, is this book available on CD, audio at all?
I don't know if it's on audio yet. It's certainly on Kindle at the moment. I know that it just went up on Amazon.
I have
a website called secretsofpeople.com, and I tweet at Never Get Sick.
Oh. And you get a lot of response when you're tweeting about this?
I'm just starting to. As I said, the book has really only been out for 2 or 3 weeks.
Right.
And it's just starting to build an audience. It takes a while for, you know, because I'm not a celebrity, I'm not on Oprah right away. So a book like this, when it works by a slow build. I'm certainly hoping that this will become a Christmas book.
Present. Yeah. Have your emails been pretty positive to, as far as reaction to the book?
Well, the emails mostly, frankly, are people telling me their secrets.
Really?
They're emailing what they think I should have put in the book or what keeps them healthy.
Well, tell us some ones that you got that you see that seem like they might be great, you know, good ideas.
Well, there's one I actually don't know anything about. I've gotten it a few times in the last week, and I'm going to have to look into it, which is colloidal silver. And I'm not even sure exactly how that interacts with your health, and so I'm going to have to go and look that one up. I certainly get a lot of other foods. People recommend pomegranates or oranges or diets that are more limited. I actually ran into somebody who is a fruitarian as opposed to a vegetarian, somebody whose diet consists entirely of fruit. I've run into people who are raw food people. They only eat non-cooked food. But my favorite was a woman in Kansas City. After I gave a lecture, she stood up and said, "I know the secret to staying healthy." And I said, "What's that?" She goes, "Divorce your husband."
Wow. That's pretty. Now, I've got to ask you about maggots. Now, I mean, what is up with maggots? Are they really good for you to eat?
Well, to eat? No. I'm not saying that you want to.
So in what way are they good for you?
Maggot therapy is something that was used to treat wounds for many, many, many years. And in fact, it's coming back because not only do maggots devour, they eat the dead tissue from open wounds, which you want to get rid of, but they actually secrete a solution that is not unsimilar to ammonia that eradicates bacteria. So what they've actually discovered is, believe it or not, maggots can be really good for your health, but not to eat. I'm not saying go eat maggots.
Well, I'm seeing maggots are on the list, and I'm thinking, I wonder what that's all about. I mean, right away, these things are shocking when you first see them. They're eating the dirt and the hot and the cold showers, and you know. And
well, one of the things I do in the introduction is I talk about a lot of the things that people thought may have been old wives' tales that actually end up being medically verifiable, like having cranberry juice to cure a bladder infection, or an apple a day keeps the doctor.
Oh, cranberry juice is good for a bladder infection?
Yeah, it actually is.
Wow, we'll have to keep that in mind.
It destroys the bacteria that cling to the walls of the bladder.
Wow.
And apples can prevent certain kinds of cancers. One of the things that you discover is that certainly not all of the old wives' tale and conventional wisdom is true, but some of it sure is.
Now, as far as apples, is applesauce as good as apples, or should you eat just?
It's always better to eat the whole food.
Right.
You know, if your applesauce is just crunched up apples, that's good. But since the apple skin has a lot of the nutrients in the apple, in general, you always want to eat the whole food. You want to have the orange, not the orange juice. You know, you want to have the potato, not the potato chip.
Are there foods that you had to get to enjoy eating, or that were difficult for you to eat at first when you first started on doing some of these?
Brussels sprouts. I never really liked Brussels sprouts.
What do you do when you don't like a food and you know you have to eat it?
Really have to eat Brussels sprouts, but what I just said is I have some friends who are really good cooks, so I said to them, make me Brussels sprouts that I can eat, and they did. You know, you can find that almost anything can be good if you find a good enough cook who knows how to prepare them.
Right, and that's the beauty of life. I mean, people are here to help us out. We forget, you know, we're so, you know, it's such a fast life. Everything goes so quickly by, you know, and you forget you have people that if you only have to do is ask and they'll help.
Yep.
And, you know, and it's a shame that more people, I mean, you always hear about people that live alone or you know, are not pleasant to be around. But the friendship thing just really gets to me.
That's why it's in the book.
And there's so much now. Anybody who hasn't read the book yet can just go through all these, and it goes into detail as far as all the different 25 things. So it's going to keep you busy for a while and really get you thinking, which is really terrific. And I thank you for writing it. That's wonderful.
Thank you for having me on your program.
And this is a book you can go through again and again and again and look back and look at it again in case you forget.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us, Gene. It's been wonderful.
I hope you do take some of the secrets seriously. I hope you make them part of your life, and
absolutely.
I hope that your health improves.
Yes, definitely. I hope that for everybody who's listening, too.
Yeah. Thank you.
And this has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.